from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, The Great Deformation, former Reagan budget director David Stockman says the federal budget has turned into a fiscal doomsday machine. If the government doesn't stop cooking the books and get its debt under control, Stockman predicts a collapse of the U.S. economy. We'll talk to Stockman about his book and we'll get his take on President Obama's proposed 2014 budget, which was introduced on Wednesday. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. David Stockman served as a Michigan Republican congressman, then went on to be President Ronald Reagan's budget director from 1981 to 1985, a key architect of the Reagan Revolution and an early partner of the Blackstone Group, as well as a former private equity investor. He's the author of The Triumph of Politics, which was published back in 1986 and was a bestseller. And he recently published a new book, a tome really, called The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. David Stockman joins us for this Forum. Good to have you here.
Very good to be here.
Well, welcome. You know, a lot of people would be surprised to note what I wanted to highlight initially here, and that is David Stockman talking about the top 1% windfalls of crony capitalism. You almost sound like an Occupy guy. The guy who's associated with supply-side economics and trickle-down, you know, Reagan administration economics. This is not what people have you pegged as thinking along those lines.
Yeah, well, that was 30 years ago, and a lot of things have drifted way off course. And I think one conclusion of the book is that we ended up by 2007, 2008, when they bailed out Wall Street, about 180 degrees away from free markets, fiscal rectitude, and sound policy that I thought we were attempting to launch in 1981. Why did this happen? Well, we failed to manage the budget correctly. We cut taxes too big. We didn't cut spending. Defense got totally out of control. We entered an age of permanent deficits. Then we get Greenspan at the Fed, and he's going to make it easy by printing enough money to fund the deficits so that they don't, you know, cause harm to the economy, drive up interest rates or squeeze out capital spending. But unfortunately, Greenspan created bubble after bubble. We remember dot-com. That was a devastating crash. But before it crashed, we were at a peak level on the S&P 500, nearly where we are this morning. And we've crashed two times in between. Then, rather than learn a lesson from the dot-com crash and really the mayhem that occurred, literally millions of people lost most of their savings if they were in 401ks or the stock market, he reflated the bubble. This time we got a housing bubble, which was even more devastating. It crashed in 2008. And now you have the Fed trying to inflate the bubble for the third time. But I demonstrate in my book that all of this money printing by the Fed, which is they buy bonds, it creates new money, it never gets out of Wall Street. So it's great for the speculators and the gamblers. They can borrow money at essentially 0%.
Maybe why we're seeing the stock market doing so well
now. Of course. The stock market is basically being levitated by gamblers and by leverage. It is not reflecting a good outlook for the future of the American economy. Main Street is in serious trouble. And that's the other thing. Reagan was going to make Main Street economy boom, hum. And I believe in free enterprise and unleashing, you know, the talent and so forth of the American people. But that didn't happen once we got the Fed into bubble finance and once got into the age of permanent deficit spending.
Well, you've just given a very good cogent outline of what's in the 700 and some pages. I confess I didn't read the whole thing. People think I read books, even if they're tomes, from page to page. And
I do have a seven-word summary. Do you want that?
Well, no, you just gave me actually
well,
a pretty good
seven
summary.
Seven words are, do not believe Washington or Wall Street. And that's what all of this is about, the debate today. It's a bubble, and we need to really look very seriously at the reality.
Well, I want to look at that reality. I've seen through your eyes, and you know, it's interesting also that you even go after the GOP in what you describe as the war against the 99%, which again sounds like the Occupy movement. And you take Paul Ryan to task and really skewer him as well as others, although you say that this all originated with FDR and talk about Alan Greenspan as making some serious mistakes. But you also skewer Nixon, and you feel Nixon committed a greater sin than Watergate, even as far as the economy was concerned.
Yeah. In 1971 was the inflection point, the turning point, when he went to Camp David and basically defaulted on our international obligations under Bretton Woods. We were the fulcrum or the linchpin of the world monetary system. All currencies were fixed to the dollar. It was a good system. It was stable. It imposed discipline. Countries couldn't run massive current account deficits year after year. And Nixon basically said, this is inconvenient. I want to get reelected in 72 with a huge mandate. I want the economy booming. And so therefore, he did a lot of bad things. He put on wage and price controls. He closed the gold window. He essentially defaulted on Bretton Woods. He wrecked Bretton Woods, and he started an era of what I call monetary race to the bottom to see which central bank can print the most money. It's created a massive bubble, but it's dangerous and it's not sustainable. That's where it all started.
You say he's worse than Watergate, although he called that just a second-rate burglary. You know, you've been in all this called kind of a Cassandra, too pessimistic, too grim a picture. In fact, Paul Krugman called you a cranky old man, of all things, about that charge, that, you know, you're not necessarily seeing any silver linings here, because there aren't really many silver linings as you see things.
Well, you know, if you look at the reality on Main Street, and you can't look at Wall Street, because when you have three identical bubbles in less than 15 years, it tells you that isn't real, that isn't sustainable.
It's always been boom and bust, David, right?
Not of this magnitude. Let me tell you, not of this magnitude.
True.
Okay? And not of this destructive impact when it comes down. But let me look at Main Street, okay? And if you go back to the same point, March 2000, where the first S&P 500 reached this level, between then and now, we basically have created hardly any new jobs, okay? If we measured the unemployment rate the same way, it would be 13% today. Between that point in March 2000 and today, 27 million people of adult age have dropped out of the employed workforce, and only 6 million of them went on to Social Security old age. The rest of them have fallen into the black hole of a failing economy. They're on food stamps. They're on disability. They're living with mom and dad, or the parents are living with son and daughter.
Forgive me, but the numbers you give here are shocking.
Yes.
It's down about 1 in 5 Americans, actually.
That's right. That's right. 1 in 5 Americans are now on disability or food stamps. Another way to put it is in 2000, when the stock market was bubbling just where it is today, there were 75 million adults over 16 not employed. Today, there's 102 million. And that's not because they all retired. Okay, I say 6 million more on Social Security retirement, the remainder struggling to find some way to make ends meet, to keep life and limb together, because our economy's failing, the jobs aren't there, and that is the heart of the disconnect that I see between constant booms and speculative windfalls on Wall Street from the Fed-induced bubbles.
Really, from the money supply and what's gone into the money supply.
But it doesn't get out of Wall Street. It doesn't go to Main Street. Okay?
Talking about the figures here, and some of them really do shake up a reader, this reader at least. I mean, we have these figures that are put out. They're official figures. And like you say, they're doctored and they're played with. And so maybe, as you say, don't trust anything that comes out of the government. But 10-year deficit, you say it's over 2 times that $7 trillion figure. That's based on what?
It's based on a non-rosy scenario. What they don't tell you is the 10-year projection right now from CBO or from Obama yesterday assumes that the economy has no more problems, dislocations, or recessions between now and 2023, which would mean 14 years without a recession since the last one ended in 2009. Throughout time immemorial, we have had a recession or an economic upset or dislocation every 50, 60 months. That isn't real. It assumes that we create 17 million new jobs in the next 10 years compared to 2.5 in the last 10 years. So what I say, let's just cut and paste the economic performance of the last 10 years on a go-forward basis, same unemployment, same very anemic growth rates, all the other variables, and project the budget based on that, because frankly, the headwinds coming at the American economy from all over the world. You know, Japan is going into terminal bankruptcy. China is going to have a crash landing one of these days. Europe is unraveling at the seams.
The whole global economy is a house of cards, really.
Yes. So therefore, to assume that you go to 2023 and we're at full employment and the unemployment rate is 5% and nothing ever bad happens, that's, you know, I was accused of rosy scenario back when we did our forecast.
Nobody would accuse you of that anymore.
No, but what I'm saying is they're doing it again. So if you're realistic and sober about what the budget projections, particularly revenue, would be based on not even a bad outcome, not something that I'm talking about, a real crisis, but simply the same performance we've had over the last 10 years, which has had its ups and downs, we would be 15 to 20 trillion into red ink. And what Obama's talking about today are just little pinpricks. He's not telling the truth to middle class that all of them are going to pay more taxes, not just the 2%. The whole middle class is going to have to pay more taxes to close this gap and help us pay our bills. Secondly, Social Security, the affluent retirees are going to have to lose their benefits or have them cut back. We need to protect Social Security for the low income and those that have only a Social Security check. But there are a lot of people around with big bank accounts and large savings and annuities and investment income and so forth, and they're still getting the full check. That can't be. We can't afford it. And finally, defense. It's crazy that he's keeping defense above $600 billion when Bill Clinton left it at $400 billion. And I don't think anybody was going to attack us in the year 2000 because we have no industrial enemies left. So I really fault Obama for kind of sugar-coating the whole thing. He's unwilling to take on the military-industrial complex. He is unwilling to take on the generals. He doesn't want to tell the truth to the middle class because that would make him unpopular. But why was he elected a second term? This is his first year of his second term. I've watched this long enough. I've been in Washington since 1970 to know that the first year of the second term is the only opportunity a president has to lead. And he is simply fiddling while Rome burns. I'm very critical, and I think it's warranted.
We're talking with David Stockman, former director of the budget during the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1985, who says the machinery of government is massively failing us, and you don't really offer any solutions here. You say if you could change the whole political system, highly unlikely, or if you could ban the banks from funding or underwriting or getting involved in any kind of financial markets, which is, you know, also out of the realm of Ripley's, believe it or not, in that realm, yeah. Maybe. So again, you know, your pessimism is pretty unrelenting.
Well, it might be unrelenting, but I think there's no hope of ever reversing the deterioration that's underway unless we're at least honest and sober about what the problems are and where we're drifting.
Does honesty and sobriety help us diminish this problem, you think?
I don't know.
I know you have training at Harvard Divinity School, but yeah. That not
well, in the Old Testament, it worked occasionally. So anyway, the only thing I'm saying is that the whole country was shocked in 2008 with the Wall Street meltdown, and we've done nothing about the big banks. And I say if they're too big to exist, if they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist. They can be broken up. It wouldn't be the end of the world. But you know why? We don't have the political will. They own the political process. Washington is like an auction house. The highest bidder wins the policy prize.
But you know, we're leaving out an important piece here, if I may. I mean, you've been talking about the welfare state and debt and printing money, you know, like it's going out of style. But warfare, I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, I mean, certainly talk about it in the book. That's a big piece of it.
Oh, yes. You know, when I say the state or government is out of control, I mean both the welfare state and the warfare state. And I do not believe any of these invasions and occupations that we've had recently, Iraq and Afghanistan, going all the way back to the 60s in Vietnam, where I was a, you know, anti-war protester, and that's really where I got involved in politics originally. I think we've been making mistakes for a half century meddling in the world. trying to be the policeman. I was just in Vietnam. You know, we did a little family trip. And I was just stunned and staggered by the mayhem and destruction we caused there. And look at it today. It's kind of a mini China, booming, more or less state capitalism. What were we doing there? Why did a million people perish? Why did 57,000 U.S. soldiers, why were they sacrificed? What was the point? And that is a pretty sobering lesson, and yet we've done it over and over, and we have this big warfare state. And we finally, here's my point, and I think it's cogent. I worked hard in 1968, first for Bobby Kennedy and then McCarthy, because I wanted the peace candidate to win. I wanted this nonsense that was going on in Vietnam. I was 20 years old or whatever, to stop. Finally, by 2008, we elect a peace candidate for the first time. And what does he do? He beats his mandate for plowshares into bigger swords. The budget under Obama, the defense budget, is bigger in real terms than it was under Bush, and that was a disaster.
Well, we had no war during the Reagan administration, although there were invasions in Grenada, and there were other things that went on, and of course, in Panama and all that. But, you know, when you say Obama won't stand up to the military-industrial complex, Reagan's defense buildup was one of the hallmarks of his presidency, and the Washington Post called it free spending crusade.
Yes,
of free spending.
You know, but I have a whole chapter showing what a disaster that was.
You were at the center of it, though.
I was fighting it all the way. That's one, you know, in the famous Greater Education of David Stockman, one of the things that I got in trouble for was that I said the Pentagon is a swamp of waste. And I was the budget director, and I was quoted, and that became, you know, a sensation. I survived the whole thing, but I lay out in my book that the predicate for this massive, unnecessary buildup was that the Soviet Union was nearing a first strike capability with nuclear weapons. That was entirely a myth. It was entirely a phony scare kind of thing that came from the neocons, but it led Reagan to agree to a massive budget for 5 years for the Defense Department, $1.5 trillion, and big numbers in those days, let me tell you. And then when it came time to use the money, the Pentagon itself realized it couldn't. There wasn't anything we could put into strategic weapons that would counter the Soviet threat, which wasn't real. So guess what? They put it all into conventional military buildup, the 600-ship Navy, massive expansion of the land forces and equipping of the land forces with new tanks and armored personnel carriers and attack helicopters and close air support, and I could go on. But the point I'm making is that Reagan inadvertently built a conventional war machine that became the instrument of invasion and occupation after he left office and the Soviet Union disappeared, because we couldn't get rid of it. In other words, I don't think the Bushes could have started these wars, any of these wars,
had it not been for President Reagan?
If the war machine wasn't there. If they had to say to Congress, we're going to have a $400 billion increase in spending over the next 3 years to massively mobilize the capability we need to invade, you know, the Middle East the first time in 1990 or the second time especially, or Afghanistan, I don't think it would have happened. But when it was there, all they had to do is, you know, fund the operating costs, and you never had to go to the taxpayers and say, this is so important, we're really going to lay the wood to you so that we can go, make democracy happen in Iraq or get rid of weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. So the warfare state is a huge piece of the fiscal mess that we're in today. And here we are 20 years later, and I say this in the book, we have no industrial state enemies. The Soviet Union obviously is long gone. The Cold War ended 20 years ago. Russia today...
You think Putin is a friend of ours now?
No, but yeah, good question. But Russia today is a kleptocracy. They're more interested there in stealing from each other than they are harming their neighbors.
It's run outside of Putin by oligarchs, and they're essentially capitalist oligarchs.
That's right. But, I mean, it's not a military threat, okay? China is basically the export factory of the world. They can't go around attacking everybody because they're attacking their customers. They're going to bomb all the Walmarts in America.
Well, we're too much in debt to them. But also, what about—
So my point is—
Are you leaving out North Korea?
I mean, you know, there's a tobacco, you know, guy rules that, but it's not a threat to the United States. So why do we have 11 carrier battle groups? Why do we have 1.5 million men and women still under arms? Why do we have 800,000 civilians supporting the 1.5 million under arms? Why do we have a million in the arm, the reserves in the National Guard? You know, we spend a quarter of a trillion a year just on the cost of all that manpower, and that's a conventional war-fighting machine. There are no industrial enemies. There are no nuclear enemies to use it on. It's a total, if you look at it historically, someday, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, historians will say, what were they thinking? Why did they have this massive armada and warfighting machine when there was no use for it anywhere in the world?
No, but there were a lot of defense contractors who were lobbying Congress. Money that's involved in this, of course, is at the center of it. And we're talking to David Stockman, former budget director in the Reagan administration and the author of a new book called Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. And you may want to chime in here. He's saying essentially we're living on borrowed time. We're spending money, Asian money, a lot of it, and also trying to point out that it's become, well, like I said before, a house of cards, that the day of reckoning is at hand, not only for the United States, but Europe and Japan and China. And if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, we'd welcome hearing from you. You can join us now at our toll-free number. It's available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your call, so feel free to join the program. Any questions or comments, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you have immediately on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You've been hitting hard on Reagan, your former boss, and Nixon and so forth, but also on Obama. And the fact of the matter is that when Krugman and you came clashing over your views and everything, a lot of it had to do with just how much of the stimulus was useful. And Krugman's taken a position all along that maybe more stimulus money had to be spent. It wasn't enough. The hands were tied and they were shackled and so forth. We're talking about New York columnist Paul Krugman, of course.
Right.
And as I said, called you a cranky old man. That was not nice. But the fact of the matter is,
you did wonders for the book sales. I mean,
okay. Well, but respond to the essential criticism. I mean, it's not only that he talks about your job figures and he talks about a lot of things. But I mean, the heart of the criticism is, it seems to me, that you've overstated things and you're not really seeing things. Are you seeing things, the old proverb about the glass half empty, much too much, and not necessarily giving credit to the fact that the stimulus bill. And I saw your statistics.
Right.
They're pretty alarming. Only about 5% of, quote, needy people getting any that money. But
right.
Krugman said, you know, those are deceiving statistics, too.
Well, I don't think it is. Only $30 billion of the $800 went to needs-tested people. And I support that. And I think that's the one thing that government ought to be doing today. Financing and supporting and improving the safety net through three programs at least, earned income tax credit. That's the way to help people who are barely scraping by on minimum wage jobs or part-time jobs. You supplement what they're earning with a tax credit, and we ought to actually make the tax credit even more generous. But we need to reserve our money for helping those at the bottom, for helping those that are left behind, the 20 million that I talk about that have disappeared from the labor force and a lot more. We should not be spending the limited money we have, and this is where I disagree with Krugman entirely, on things like green energy boondoggles. We've got one now, Fisker Automotive. You know, this company is a venture capital auto company trying to make electric vehicles started by Kleiner Perkins. You know, they're billionaires over there, and the government put in $500 million so some cat by the name of Fisker can put out a electric vehicle that will cost $100,000 in the high-end version and only $50,000 in the low-end version. And why do we do that?
It's a waste of money. You didn't mention Solyndra.
Well, Solyndra was another one. But the point is, the automobile companies of the world will come up with whatever the consumer wants to buy. If you want them to buy electric vehicles, raise the gas tax. Don't give money to Kleiner Perkins. Don't give money to billionaire venture capitalists. This company is going to file for bankruptcy any day. It's another Solyndra.
We'll come back more with David Stockman and you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, David Stockman, who says this modern Keynesian state of ours, this republic we live in, is broke and broken, and has a new book essentially outlining why and detailing why. He was director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan administration and former U.S. congressman. The book is called The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. And let us go right to your calls, and we'll bring you into this conversation. Laura, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for including me. I look forward to reading the book. So this dialogue that you're having has prompted me to think about how do we get ahead of this? Part of what you all are talking about is how many of the nations are in financial complex situation because we're so intertwined, and our paradigm is something that is no longer valuable. But if we look at our assets, which is a very good population, a greatly stable environment, a population that's educated, well-educated, and diligent in work. So what do we do with this, all of these assets, to get ahead of this new environment that we live in, which is one in which it's a big consumer world, and how do we transform what we're doing in the U.S. to take us to the next stage of the economy?
David Stockman.
Well, that's really a very good question and some great observations, and I guess I would start this way. I, too, believe the Main Street America is a productive place with a lot of talent in our people and in our history and in our education and training, but it's being imperiled by two big agencies of government that are out of control. The Federal Reserve. We need massive reform and change on the Federal Reserve so it stops creating bubbles, so it stops basically siphoning our financial wealth into the casinos where it basically gets traded at high velocity and ends up as windfall to the smartest traders, but it's not going into productive investment in any of our industries, old, new, or in between.
So, and forgive me, you see no distinction between Bernanke and Greenspan?
Only that Bernanke is far worse. Bernanke is the best friend the 1% ever had. He's the worst friend that Main Street ever had because on the one hand, today he's crushing anyone who is a saver, anyone who's on fixed income. Let's say you saved $100,000 over a lifetime because you were frugal. You worked hard, two jobs. You didn't buy a new car every year. You've got $100,000 and you're trying to live on it plus your Social Security check. Guess what? Under Bernanke's writ, you're getting $400 a year. That's all you're getting for a lifetime of frugality and savings because he has decided that he can make the economy better with 0% interest rates when the people on Wall Street are using that 0% money to laugh all the way to the bank and various trading stratagems that we can talk about. So that is really big, and until that changes what the caller talked about, in other words, mobilizing the asset base that we have in the talent of Main Street is going to be difficult. Secondly,
but also, different leadership. I mean, you take Paulson to task, for example, for not standing firm.
Paulson was
George W. Bush.
Yeah. But Paulson, you mentioned that I sounded like an occupier. What I meant to say was Paulson was occupying the Treasury building. Goldman Sachs was occupying the Treasury building. The bailouts in TARP in the fall of 2008 were about saving the last remnants of Wall Street standing. Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs. That's what it was about. There was not a Great Depression 2.0 lurking around the corner. The Main Street banks of America, like community banks,
See, that's what I mean by bad leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, taking your paradigms here, you know, Reagan looks at the threat completely through a kind of occluded vision, and the same is held true for Paulson and George W. Bush. I don't mean to single out the Republicans here, but, you know, looking at threats and looking at menaces, whether it's a red menace or whether it's know, the USSR on the one hand or coming down Wall Street depression, you're saying essentially the leadership didn't see what was around the corner. They didn't have a periscope and they couldn't see what was around the corner and were too threatened.
Well, that's part of it, and it's also part of the Republican Party's abysmal failure, and they need to be blamed especially because Republicans are the job of the Republican Party in a democracy like ours is to be the watchdog, protect the free market, protect the Treasury, do not allow massive debts to grow up, require the central bank to have a narrow, limited mission and not become, like I call it, the monetary Politburo, trying to run the whole economy out of their building in Washington. And the Republican Party failed on every one of those jobs because it was trying to out, bid the Democrats.
I feel like I'm talking to Arianna Huffington. I mean, she came in here and also served the Reagan administration. You're both talking very similar rhetoric these days. Let me go to another caller here, though. Yeah. Isaac, join us. Hi. Isaac, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I'm sorry. I just want to quickly say that Mr. Stockman, you remind me of George Wallace when he renounced segregation. I was in college when you were on the Reagan's administration, forcing down interest rates, forcing us into a recession just as I graduated from college. And now you're closing up to NPR like you've been a progressive all these years. I remember when you were quite the conservative, and it's interesting to hear you now speak apologetically about the Keynesian policies of Ronald Reagan. He was the greatest Keynesian while you were sitting there working for him that has sat in that seat since FDR. All that military spending was the source of our great economic recovery during the Reagan administration. And even though the conservatives now give him credit for bringing the recovery through conservative means, it was actually his profligate spending that induced that recovery, and to the point where you had great Wall Streeters like Walter Wriston, who was president of the Citicorp, I'm showing my age now at the time, basically saying that there was no correlation between money supply and interest rates. And I'd like to for you to...
Hey, bring up some important points, yeah. Isaac, and I'd like to hear what David Stockman has to say, but I'm actually looking at an email here that dovetails with what you just said. It's from Roger, who says, it seems that when he, meaning David Stockman, was Reagan's budget director, Mr. Stockman blew the opportunity to lead toward fiscal responsibility.
Well, there's a lot of points made
there. A lot of stuff
there.
Coming at you, David. Go ahead.
First of all, during that period, I fought all of the things that were just described, the military buildup. I was constantly overrun, overturned, overruled by Reagan because on the military issue, he just was naive. He listened to the generals and he used a phrase over and over, which was maddening to a budget man who was trying to make ends meet. And that was, when it comes to defense, you don't spend a budget, you spend what you need. Well, I mean, if you ask the Pentagon and the military industrial complex to define need, it gets to be pretty big. So number one, I fought that but failed. Second, after the tax cut in 1981, within months of us taking office, I realized we'd gone way too far in the tax cut because there was a bidding war, frankly, on Capitol Hill, and the Democrats bid as aggressively to cut all kinds of taxes, including for every special interest group known to man. And we ended up with a bidding war and a tax cut that was too big. So suddenly, by the fall of 1981, when the inflation cure was starting to work, and I supported totally what Volcker was doing, we had to get rid of the double-digit inflation, the budget blew wide open, the deficit became huge, and from that point until I left, resigned because I couldn't justify it anymore in 85, I worked to correct the damage. And I was then denounced by the supply-siders. I was run out of the church, so to speak, and I was kind of labeled both a Judas and a tax grabber. In other words, I convinced the president to sign three bills in a row, 1983, 1984, to raise taxes and capture back some of the excess reduction we had made.
When were you charged with there was a whole federal charge against you. They dropped it in 2009.
Oh, that was nothing to do with this. This was...
No, I'm talking about your resignation. That came later?
No. That was 1985. Okay. I resigned from the Reagan administration in 1985 because I could no longer justify these massive deficits.
It had nothing to do with the charges.
No. And so the point then is that in my book, I agree with what was said, that Reagan ended up, not because he intended it. I think his intentions were okay. The math didn't work. Defense got out of control. When you're dealing with powerful interest groups, easily a plan on paper can be turned into a
Reagan was saying, we're not going to raise taxes, we're going to balance the budget, and we're going to spend more on defense. I mean, you just think, I mean, elementary school, you know that's not going to work.
Well, okay, in theory, if you spend a little more on defense, maybe, but we spent massively for more. If we're going to cut domestic spending a lot, maybe, but we cut hardly any. And the taxes, as I said, we've got double the size
we wanted. But there were lots of cuts in the Reagan administration. I remember them well, particularly for the blind and the disabled and people who were in need. I mean,
We reformed some of the entitlements. So the food stamp program was a little out of control. We reformed that. We tried to cut programs like farm subsidies and export subsidies to the big corporations and so forth. But at the end of the day, Republicans in Congress didn't want to cut very much, either that went to companies and business or private interests or even reform the entitlements. So my point is, Reagan ended up, despite his intention of having the biggest Keynesian stimulus in modern times. And between 8 years of Reagan and 4 years of Bush after him, they tripled the national debt. It was $1 trillion when I went in, and by the time Bush left in 1992, it was pushing $4 trillion. So I agree with that. Now, have I totally abandoned all that? No. What I said in my book in 1986 when I explained the failure of the Reagan Revolution, that was the subtitle of my book, The Triumph of Politics. That's what it means. Politics overruled the ideas. I said the three principles that I believe in are free markets, fiscal rectitude, which means living within your means, not creating these massive Keynesian deficits, and sound money, which meant you don't go creating bubbles by running the printing press too high. I still believe those. My book today in 2013 is about 80 years of deviation from those fundamental principles. And Reagan ended up being deviating as much from those.
From his own principles.
Yeah, of his own.
Yeah. But, let me bring some more callers into here. We go to George. George, join us.
Good morning. Mr. Stockman, I've heard you say just the other day there's no money in the Social Security Trust Fund. Yet Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, has signed a fiduciary statement, the trustees report, in which he stipulates the trust fund contains $2.7 trillion in U.S. Treasury bonds. Are you accusing Tim Geithner of falsifying a fiduciary statement?
Well, I think if he were under Sarbanes-Oxley, like most CEOs and CFOs are every quarter, he would have to have a little longer statement than to say that, because there is paper intragovernmental loans or securities in the trust fund, but they're not real assets. They can't be cashed in. There is no way that they can be turned into payments to retirees in next year or 10 years from now or ever. It is simply a promise that when the Social Security Trust Fund asks, the U.S. Treasury will tax people harder than it is today with other taxes, or borrow money to pay off what I call this confetti. It's just make-believe internal government debt that will not pay one Social Security check when the time comes. And we should stop pretending that this is some kind of trust fund program. It's just a year-by-year, pay-as-you-go proposition. And we're crushing low-income workers with a payroll tax to fund it because of the myth of a trust fund. If we didn't have this myth of a trust fund, and if we didn't have all these affluent retirees pulling a Social Security check that they don't need and we can't afford, we would actually reduce the payroll tax because it's the biggest job killer that we have going in our society today. But frankly, the progressives and the liberals keep defending Social Security as a political knee-jerk matter. And what they're doing is throwing low-wage workers under the bus of a 15% payroll tax, you know, employee-employer, which is killing jobs and killing their take-home pay. So, you know, I think this is a big mess and there's a lot of lies.
How do you respond to a listener like this, Judith, who writes, Social Security still has plenty of money. It does not cause indebtedness for the U.S. And in the future, if adjustments are not made, it may pay out less, but there are several easy fixes. Please don't link it to the deficit or Medicare, which are different stories.
That is the that is Washington mythology. That is Washington scam, as I don't know how I could say it more clearly.
Well, you said it pretty clearly.
No, but of the roughly $3 trillion that this writer thinks is in there to pay future benefits, It is all confetti. It is not real. There's no cash there. You can't turn it into a check that can be cashed and won't bounce.
You want to go back to the gold standard, David? Like William
Denny, I think
Ryan,
we know. Well, he was against it.
I think, like Clarence Darrow. Yeah.
No, we need to have a disciplined financial system and a Federal Reserve that's not trying to run the economy. And there is a way to do that by going back to the original bank that was set up in 1914 by Carter Glass. Now, he's a great hero to people because of Glass-Steagall, and he was right about that. But he was an even greater hero when he created the Fed. And he never would have agreed with this massive bond purchasing and this massive money printing that flows into the canyons of Wall Street. And under the old system that he set up, which did have gold backing, you never could have done it.
Let me get another caller on. Gregory, that's you. Thank you for waiting. Join us with David Stockman. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Michael, for having this stunning guest on your program. This is a shining moment for your program and for NPR in general, which is, of course, the most honest station on the air. And, Mr. Stockman, I'm stunned at you, sir, having worked for years at the heart of the politics, and yet you still have the intelligence and the courage and the honesty to tell it like it is. And I am so, so grateful. And I feel personally, you may not agree with me, but I feel personally that the worldwide economies are so intertwined now, and the failure of these small economies around the Mediterranean are the first symptoms of a worldwide economic bird flu, if you will allow me to use that term, and that eventually we're going to be faced with a worldwide economic collapse, which paradoxically will be the best thing that could happen, although tremendous suffering will result, of course. But the tremendous for the environment, it will be the best thing that could ever happen, because with a worldwide economic collapse, it would give the environment a vacation.
Well, Gregory, thank you for those comments. In fact, you are getting a number of supportive comments. Chris tweets, this guy you have on now is echoing Joseph Stiglitz back in 2008. He's right on. Nothing's changed. Christine writes on our website, I've been waiting a long, long time to hear the words you have said on this program today. If a bank is too big to fail, it is too big to exist, and there is no political will to break them up. Thank you, David Stockman, for writing and saying what needs to be said. I particularly appreciate how you balance the discourse of welfare with that of warfare. Question, is your book premised on the notion that capitalism has been corrupted or that capitalism is corrupting? It's an important distinction.
Well, that's a great question, and it's clearly the former. Capitalism has been corrupted by this bubble of finance out of the Fed and by the crony capitalist system of Washington, where basically, the policy is up for bids to the high, it's an auction. It's an auction house. It's not a house of the people. It's not the kind of government that embodies political democracy as we've known it historically. So very serious problems, but it's due to the corruption of capitalism and the corruption of democracy. See, it's interactive. That's why I call it crony capitalism. It's not
Why'd you leave OMB for a high-paying job in Wall Street?
Well, I didn't leave OMB. I basically could no longer justify what was going on. I didn't, resign loudly in protest because I didn't feel that was the right way to function. But it was obvious when I left that I disagreed entirely with Reagan. I wrote a book saying,
but you went to the canyons, I'll use your metaphor. Yeah. You went to the canyons of Wall Street.
Yes, right. And then I spent a career there, and I got caught up in the bubble myself, and I'm the first to admit it. And it because it was so easy to get debt, and because the debt rates were so low, and because the tax code favored borrowing, it favored capital gains, and so therefore, if you're a bus driver and pay taxes on your wage, you don't get any of this, and therefore, it created a false economy in what I call the LBO and financial speculation business.
I like this question, and okay. I think you will too, from Art in Palo Alto. It says, I am sympathetic with Mr. Stockman's views about the economy, but most of what he has said so far are in generalities. What specific tax reform proposals would he support? And this is what I like. How about getting Blackstone Hedge Fund, he says his Blackstone, and equity colleagues to support eliminating the carry interest tax loopholes that richly benefit them?
Absolutely. It is an outrage to have the carried interest to treat what is essentially the professional income of people who run these hedge funds and run these private equity funds taxed at only 15%. Now, that goes to a bigger issue. We should tax all income if we're going to have income taxation at the same rate, level playing field.
You see Forbes? You want a flat income tax?
Not flat. I'm saying same rate.
Oh, the same rate.
Okay, now this is important because we need to tax capital gains, dividends, wage and salary earnings, interest income, any source of income at the same rate. And Reagan actually did it, and nobody gives him credit. In the 1986 reform, he put the rate at 28% on everything. And then what happened over the next 10 years, including, unfortunately, under Carter because of Rubin, Clinton because of Rubin, they put the capital gains tax all the way down to 15% eventually under Bush. And they raised the income tax rate all the way to 39. It created a massive incentive to convert or income into capital gains, and it made the playing field so unlevel that it's not fair. So my solution, you ask, what is the solution? Let's fix the rates. Let's make all income the same, eliminate all loopholes, and you can have a three-tier tax, a three-tier income tax, a lower and a middle and an upper, but you're never going to get rid of all this complexity, in my view, because K Street owns every one of those loopholes. Every one of those loopholes is claimed to be a job creator, and therefore, it's never going to happen. That's the tragedy of where we are today because of money politics, and that's why I propose public finance only for elections and that incumbents can't run for re-election after one six-year term.
Harris Yule joining us. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, David. To reduce it down to its essentials, isn't the real problem here that everything we've been talking about the last 50 minutes, our system of celebrated and completely legalized bribery we call lobbying? And I have a follow-up, too, please.
Yes. Okay. Oh,
yeah.
I said that, but that goes to the heart of the problem. In other words, we have money-dominated, PAC-dominated, lobbyist-dominated government. It's no longer a democracy. It's an auction. So therefore, I have three radical changes that probably won't get done, but they tell you what could happen and how far we are from it today. One, lengthen the terms of House, Senate, and President to 6 years, but say you never can run for re-election. Only once. You're a citizen legislator, then you go back to where you were in life. Now, what does that mean? It means from the day you take the oath of office, you never worry about raising one dime. You don't go trotting down to K Street to placate all the interest groups. You don't have to be introduced to all the PACs and so forth. I don't care if you're left, right, socialist, libertarian. You go in there and fight for ideas and for what you believe is the best for the country. Now, the second thing is, on the one time you run, you can only use public money. 8-week elections, one time each person runs to win his 6-year term, and only public money, no private money. So therefore, we overturn Citizens United. There's no corporate money, no labor money, no rich people money, and there's not even any private money. We have a clean process. And finally, we have a ban, a lifetime ban on anybody who's been on the congressional payroll to lobby in the governmental process.
That's some specific proposals just a little bit of time left here, and I wanted to get you talking a little bit about deficits. In fact, Robert from down the South Bay says, how do you guys feel about the statement that Reagan proved deficits don't matter? I think it was Dick Cheney who said that. But another listener, Francis in Sonoma, says, please ask your guests about the subsidy and tax credits that the oil industry enjoys. I'm less concerned that the government giving money to an electric company than continuing to give money to oil companies. They certainly don't need the money or the special tax treatment. Contributing to subsidize oil companies is going in the wrong direction. Actually, I wanted to read something else about deficits, but thank you, Francis, for that. I agree with Mr. Stockman about Wall Street versus Main Street. However, on deficits, it's tiring to hear another conservative argue the deficits during a recession are bad. Does Mr. Stockman distinguish between printing money during a boom and a recession, or is it all the same for him?
Well, the recession ended in June 2009, and as far as I can tell, we're in 2013, and the policy of the White House is to keep stimulating the economy through 2017. All right. Now, that isn't a cycle, and that's the big argument we're having in this country. Is this a structural problem or is this a cyclical problem? I say the boom that was created by Greenspan and Bush in 05, 06, and 07 created phony prosperity, jobs that weren't real, jobs that disappeared, and revenue that came into the Treasury that wasn't sustainable. Now we're getting back to a more sustainable, slow growth because our economy, private and public, has too much debt. We're not in a cycle. We're dealing with the aftermath of a 30-year debt party, and therefore you can't say, just keep running the deficit at almost $1 trillion a year because the economy has not yet recovered.
David Sackman, good to have you on. It's been a pleasure. Again, David Sackman's new book is called The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. It'll be at the Commonwealth Club at 6 o'clock this evening. Thank you
Great.
So much. Well, it's Thursday, and we have started dedicating a few minutes every other Thursday to follow up on past segments and listener feedback, and we received hundreds of comments from listeners regarding our show on NPR's decision to stop producing Talk of the Nation. And during that show, KQED President John Bolin asked for suggestions on what to air in the show's place. Here's John Bolin speaking with guest host Scott Schaefer.
And it's right around the lunch hour, and we're interested in what listeners in the Bay Area would most value at that time of the day. Is it a live call-in show like Forum? Forum and Talk of the Nation had quite a bit in common in that regard. Or is it another kind of programming?
And Sandy wrote us to say, I feel that it may have been too difficult for listeners to get past the cancellation news to be able to make constructive suggestions. What about having another show or a special place on KQED.org for such suggestions? Of course, people may continue to vent, but maybe some people out there are thinking rationally now. Well, you might be right, Sandy. We certainly received a lot of passionate comments from people upset with the news, and KQED still wants to hear suggestions for what to put in Talk of the Nation's place. Listeners should email ideas to press@kqed.org. That's press@kqed.org. And there's been an update on a story we covered late last month about the faulty bolts installed on the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge. When we covered the story, Steve Heminger, who is head of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, was fairly confident that the scheduled Labor Day opening for the span could still be met. Officials were not so confident at a press conference earlier this week.
At this point in time, we don't see that. We're not going to make the schedule, but there are unknowns out there. We need to have a very clear plan, a very clear design that there is very high confidence in before we're finally saying that either we're good to go or not. We have to acknowledge a risk at this point in time, but it's not the time to make a decision or determination that we either are or are not going to make that schedule.
That was Tony Anziano, chief engineer at the California Transportation Commission, and during that same press conference, officials discussed the possibility that the faulty bolts could have been damaged by rainwater. And lastly, we heard from listeners who said that our show on how to get to zero waste was unclear on how to dispose of cat litter. So, to clarify, cat litter should go in your landfill bin. And to reiterate on coffee cups, the plastic top should be recycled, the soiled paper cup should be composted, and the unsoiled cardboard sleeve should be recycled. Thanks for the feedback, and please keep it coming. A reminder that all of our shows are archived online at kqed.org/forum. Until next time. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And our interns are Lauren Benishu, Jasmine Wynn, and Nora McCartan. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.